And, you know, it's spoilers. Turns out Tarantino wasn't being as racist as I thought he was. It was just the whole damn movie. It was just a weird film.
He didn't drop the N-word.
No, he did. I mean, he didn't write.
No, he does say something in Japanese that was not translated on Amazon. So I'm not convinced he didn't.
There are good movies and there are great movies, but that's not what we watch here, because this is Shitty Cinema.
The sound of the Gion Shoulder Bells.
We are three film masochists who love to take on the worst movies we can find, centered around our monthly theme to answer one simple question. Would you watch it again? I'm Jay, and I'm joined by Dave.
No, call me Henry.
And Casey.
No.
Every week, one of us has to pick a movie based on that month's theme. What's this month's theme, Casey?
This month, we got a little busy, and we didn't have too much time to prepare, so we're gonna pull the dog at our homework card. Last week, Jay pulled something that was crumpled out of the bottom of his bag. Big Trouble in Little China. Dave, I don't know where you found this, but don't you ever turn in something like this again. What did you bring?
This week, we watched something that I don't remember what streaming service I found it on. It was a movie that I found on some streaming service where I didn't know anything more than the title and the poster of it. And I just clicked on it going, all right, let's see what this is about. I was immediately greeted by Quentin Tarantino. He did something so racist, I screamed out loud, whoa!
That checks out. Yeah.
And I proceeded to watch the rest of the movie, and I've been looking for an excuse to bring it to Shitty Cinema ever since. And it doesn't really work with any of our usual themes, so fuck it. It's going to have to work this week.
Oh, God.
So this week, we watched Sukiyaki Western Django, which is a lot, so I'm probably just going to be calling it Western Django a lot from here on out.
Dave, before we go too far, we're going to need an elevator pitch where you sell us on this movie in 10 seconds or less. Here's your setup. You made the poor decision to step off the path to take a piss, and when you did, you didn't see the gang coming that is about to kidnap you and use you as a human shield for their Gatling gun. So in the 10 seconds before you become meat shield to protect someone else's weapon, sell us on this movie.
A gunslinger gets between color-coded gangs to help a mute kid whose grandfather is a potentially time-traveling Tarantino.
6 seconds!
There's a lot of other plots, but that's really all that matters.
Yeah, was he a time traveler?
I don't know. The timelines don't match up from the story he's telling. So, like, I think that just might be Quentin Tarantino. And at some point yet to come, he unlocks time travel.
He's like, make me look like I was a side character in Labyrinth at the end. That's what I want.
Right. Because, like, the beginning of the movie is him telling the story of the movie, right?
No.
He's talking about an event that happened 2,000 years in the past.
Oh. So it's just an unrelated...
Yeah, it's like, oh, the wheel of time thing. Continues.
Hundreds of years in the past? Yeah, it was... The idea is that the central tension between the Heikis and the Genjis goes back centuries.
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah,
this
yeah, yeah.
very long
I'm just
thing.
Talking about the presence of specifically Tarantino. It's just this thing that happened at some point well prior to the events of the film. Because
yeah,
not,
yeah.
You know, 100. Casey, this vacation has gone absolutely horribly for me, and I'm afraid you are going to get caught up in this briefly, because, you see, I haven't updated the tags on my luggage in a while. And we used to be roommates back when I wrote on that one. So, like, you're actually listed as my contact in case of emergency. And so, you know, my belongings are going to be shipped to you. And because these desperados are randomly sometimes goddamn Looney Tunes characters, they're also going to ship back a suspicious ticking package that's got about 10 seconds left on the clock. Immediately from the point you took possession of it. It's actually pretty incredible. It's a testament to the U.S. Postal Service.
Rain or shine, Dave.
In the time before this package goes off, sell us on this movie.
Imagine taking Helen Keller to a Mongolian barbecue-style plot pot, add too many dashes of Tarantino, chill for 2 hours, and garnish with one fight we wanted to see.
8 seconds.
Yeah, that was savage. That was, yeah.
You just beat us up with the elevator pitch.
And this movie,
and
man.
Both of us only brought up the mute child and Tarantino, who are overall really unimportant characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I wasn't referencing the child. I was saying the plot of this movie. This movie
was the
felt
Helen
like
Keller,
as if
child?
You just gave Helen Keller a bowl of words and she grabs some out.
Oh yeah, it is very much Western paint by numbers.
No, it is Western Jackson Pollock.
If we're going to see if Casey's criticism holds up, let's go over the movie that Shitty Cinema watched. This Western Jackson Pollock, as Casey calls it.
All right, so skipping over the intro with Quentin Tarantino and an egg, I'm sure we'll talk about it at some point.
Oh boy.
Does Western... he have an egg thing?
Yeah, yeah, he cuts an egg out of the snake, and then they show up.
I don't know, but does he have like an egg kink too?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't seen it before. I'm gonna call it a one off.
Oh, okay, like, okay. Say, like, I was like, is that something I should know about him?
Who doesn't have an egg kink?
Oh yeah, you haven't noticed the egg subtext in all of his previous work.
Right, I feel like there's a lot of shit I miss sometimes.
Yeah, I know, they're always in diners, which serve a lot of eggs.
Oh, oh my god.
Yeah.
Egg-luminati confirmed.
Skipping over that, Western Django opens with a nameless gunslinger rolling into a troubled town. There's a gold rush on with rumors of a huge treasure, and two color-coded gangs, the Heikis in red and the Genjis in white, have taken over town in search of it.
It's so kind of them to choreograph their outfits like that for us.
It really helps so much.
The gangs seem more interested in fighting each other than the treasure, though both sides immediately offer the gunslinger half the gold if he'll sign up for their set of the fight. Feeling like the prettiest girl at the prom, the gunslinger mulls his options at the local tea shop.
While he's thinking about how to spend his gold, the mysterious old lady at the tea shop tells him how the town got to this point. See, before the gold rush, it was peaceful, with a new married couple from the opposing gangs even settling down there. The married couple, Akira and Shizuka, had a son, and the tea shop lady was Akira's mother. When the rumors of gold brought the Heike baddies to town, they murdered their clansman Akira in front of his own kid, and when Shizuka went to the Genjis for help, they instead decided to keep her around as a, let's call it, dancer.
So, the gunslinger is now pretty sure everybody sucks, and sets off a plan to make the gangs fight each other. While the Heikis are stealing a Gatling gun from the Genjis, the gunslinger gives Shizuki a chance to get away with her son and the lady from the tea shop. The plan works flawlessly, right up until Shizuka decides she can't leave without the rose she planted for her dead husband, and blows everything all to hell, getting herself killed and the gunslinger beaten half to death.
Okay, but have you seen the prices at nurseries? Come on! Dave, you know.
That's true. That's true. Plants are fucking expensive.
They are. Like,
they just bred this one, so like maybe this is her shot that she's like, no, if I can get this into a magazine and like rich white
birds
ladies
and blooms
want to have it.
Hold your fucking britches.
No.
I just checking in. So this means the kids now watch both of his parents murder.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure he'll just walk that off or something at some point. Before all of the main characters can be murdered, the tea shop lady reveals herself to be this film's required secret badass, a legendary retired fighter named Bloody Benton. She saves the gunslinger and takes him to be healed by the local Anasazi tribe.
Once the gunslinger's patched up, Bloody Benton reveals that she and the Anasazi tribe have had the treasure all along, and they want the gunslinger to take over as its guardian. The gunslinger shrugs his way through, and after getting some guns from Tarantino and old man makeup, the gunslinger and Bloody Benton head to town for a spring cleaning killing spree.
The Heikis and Genjis apparently agree it's time we wrap this whole fucking movie up, because everybody's in town just waiting to do this. Bloody Benton gets revenge against the stupid but lucky Heike leader that killed her son, killing him before she immediately dies off herself. When there's no one left but the Genji leader and the gunslinger, the two face off in a duel, and a sudden snowstorm with, like, an inch of ground coverage appears out of nowhere, just so this can all be extra cinematic.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. But they have similar weather to us, and I have seen that day.
I'm saying,
absolutely,
but, like,
seen that day.
I'm like, minimum, they just agreed, like, all right, we're going to wait like 15 minutes for this to look extra cool, right? Because
the Genji leader throws away his gun and charges at the gunslinger with a sword. And despite the fact that this guy can literally catch swords with his bare hands and deflect bullets in midair, the one thing he wasn't prepared for was a secret sleeve gun.
Secret sleeve gun.
With basically everyone but the kid dead, the gunslinger grabs a pocket full of gold for his trouble. He leaves the kid and the rest of the gold in the Anasazi to cover future therapy costs and then rides off into the sunset like a proper Western.
Have fun at Firefest, kid. Bye.
Bye.
Can I just say the kid was weird?
Yeah, I mean, I think the kid was supposed to be weird. In universe, he witnessed his father die firsthand, which, okay, that'll fuck a kid up. But then I do want to point out that in the movie, the child at some point later walked up to stand over his father's corpse in the street and then also apparently showed up to see it hanging from a bridge at some point. So who keeps taking this child to see his father's dead body?
No. The hanging from the bridge is
the
gunslinger's parents.
Oh, that was a flashback of the gunslinger.
Mm-hmm. Wow, Dave, how many times have you seen this movie and how much attention did you pay?
Technically three, but yeah, I was so caught off guard by the unexpected Tarantino that it really unsettled me for the rest of the film.
Yeah, no, that was he started delivering lines and my brain broke.
When you're
I
not,
need to know.
It's like, okay, this is I want to talk about this up front. This is like the yin to the yang of Animal World, because it's another movie. Yeah, for anybody who hasn't, go back and listen to our episode about Animal World, because it's another movie that I just watched at random. And whereas in that one, I got a surprise Michael Douglas, this week it's a surprise Tarantino in a movie I was not expecting them to show up in, made in a different ass country.
Yeah, he's the only non-Japanese actor in it, from what I can tell. And he gives a performance.
Yeah.
Legally,
and for anybody worried
speaking.
About that, oh, I don't want to read subtitles, it's fine. Despite being a Japanese movie, it's in English. Because the director of this is whatever the Japanese version of a weeaboo is. In a marabou?
The surprise Tarantino in the beginning, which I was not expecting, I believe you told me, I forgot. The set, the opening scene of this film, the set looks like something of like a deteriorating British kids show. And Tarantino doing a bad Southern accent and then doing a worse Japanese accent, question mark?
Yeah.
Okay. Not expecting that. I wasn't surprised. I will never say that I'm really ever surprised. Yeah. I'm always disappointed, but never surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's give some proper context and also give them the best possible chance, because Tarantino kind of deserves it. I thought the same thing when I watched this, that, wow, these sets kind of look like something out of like an old play. I thought maybe like a Japanese play. It turns out they are intended to be very clear homages to some famous woodblock prints from Japanese history, specifically in the 36 Views of Mount Fuji series. Those backgrounds just are those woodblock prints that they're acting in front of.
Okay.
Gotcha.
And personally, I actually really like it in the Tarantino, like, younger scenes versus old man Tarantino scenes, that they have this like almost play like set that it's all acted within.
Yeah, the flashbacks
world.
I liked that about it. I just was not visually expecting that in the in your face in the get go. Was such a strong opening.
Is
strong the word? That was such a pungent opening to a film.
Yeah.
Pungent.
And I was like,
definitely,
where are we going?
And then, Tarantino starts delivering some dialogue that it turns out, as I found out from IMDb trivia, is a very specific famous Japanese legend and play, or rather text. And he's actually doing an impression of a specific reading of it that's been seen before. But I'm not Japanese, so I didn't have the context for it, which means I just thought Tarantino was doing something that sounded like someone had said, do the most racist samurai movie voice you can do.
Be Pierce from Community. That's yes. I want this next reading to be.
Channel the ghost of Pierce from Community, because that's the one that he starts. The sound of I was on my couch and screamed out loud. Whoa.
I fucking went slack-jawed. I didn't know what to say. I was just staring at the screen going, what the fuck is going on right now? What the fuck?
I was mostly like, Dave. Yeah.
And then you
Dave.
Watch, right. And then you watch the rest of the movie where it's all Japanese actors speaking in English. And let's be honest, I think a few of them were doing it phonetically.
Yeah, I think they were Christina Aguilera-ing it.
Yeah, so, and you realize, like, okay, this wasn't Tarantino. This was definitely coming from the director.
Right.
But also, Quentin, you knew better, man.
I'll be honest with you. I think his entire character could be cut from the film and we would lose nothing except for whatever that performance is, which I'm not sure if that's a loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not much of a loss.
It felt very Nick Cage-ish.
Kind of. Yeah, it does have a Cage vibe.
It has a little bit of, there's a Cage frequency in there. It was a choice. On second viewing, it was a little easier to comprehend. The first time I watched it, though.
I totally agree that you could cut him out and the movie would probably be better for it. I do, however, really enjoy his gunfight in the opening sequence. It's not a good fight by any means, but it's ridiculous and it's got a like cartoony vibe to it. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's my second favorite fucking gunfight in the film.
Yeah, it's very silly. It involves Quentin Tarantino catching a snake that ate an egg that I think he wants to eat. So he has to cut the egg out of the snake and then juggle it through the air while fighting a bunch of people. It's a very good premise for a stupid action comedy kung fu movie.
After shooting the snake out of the claws of a hawk that had picked it up off the ground and was flying.
Oh yeah,
off
the snake
it.
Eats the egg and yeah, then a hawk eats the snake and he shoots the hawk to get back his egg.
Correct. Yeah.
But wasn't it one of the hawk's eggs to begin with?
No, it was the chicken's eggs. There's a chicken marching around the dead body.
There's just so much going on already.
There is. It's
yeah,
a lot. It's a lot. And it also sets like one tone for the film that they immediately shift to something different. Like it is a hard cut to a very different tone.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Quentin's character is responsible for several of these. Because again, he lifts out really easy, but if you were to cut him out, so all of this we've talked about is how he appears in the flashback sequences. He's also in the like proper movie timeline in old man makeup in a steampunk wheelchair.
I'm really glad the movie didn't go the way I thought it was going to go, which I can't even tell you where I thought it was going to go, but darker. That is going to go darker with him in the mechanical wheelchair, and I'm glad it didn't.
Yeah, no, thankfully they didn't. They did let us know that, as we mentioned in the plot, he's Akira's father. Oh, no, we didn't actually mention that in the plot. Quentin is Akira's father.
Okay.
Which the movie didn't need at all.
Yeah, right. Why? How did that help us?
The only way that it helps us is for the one intentional joke of this movie that landed for me, which
Don't
is when Quentin
Don't
explains why the kid's name is Akira and says, I guess it's because I've always been an anime otaku at heart. And the other character looks at him and just says, what? Because he doesn't understand why Quentin Tarantino's just broken the shit out of the fourth wall.
Right?
Yes.
It's
that
not
was
that
the
kind
best
of movie. But
acting
they just...
in the movie.
That
was that
what?
Guy.
That what absolutely ended me.
Same. I thought you were going to say Quentin Tarantino's line. I was like, come on, Dave,
oh, no,
you're
no,
better
no.
than...
It's not
no,
the anime otaku.
That
it's the
guy.
What that comes after it is just so... It's not what? Big. It's just the right size.
I almost want to say that it's a Western in samurai clothing, but that doesn't really feel right. Because it's more of
The clothing is beautiful in this.
Yeah.
Well, okay, right. Now, I'm saying metaphorically. The film is...
But we need to talk about that. The clothing is...
The actual clothing.
Beautiful. Whoever did the costuming... Fucking hats off to you.
It's yes. It really is fucking incredible. They're trying to make like Western style. It's set in Western Nevada, in the ye old West, quote unquote. But they're doing it with very Japanese styles and designs and materials, and it looks fucking incredible.
Modern at the same time, like a lot with the cuts and some of the prints. Ugh.
Yeah. I absolutely love the costuming for pretty much everybody in this movie. It looks so fucking good.
The jacket that Bloody Benton is wearing when she's pissing in the backyard. That's like the ruffled velvet. Oh my God, is so beautiful.
Yes, it is. That's like one of my favorite looks. That and when they, when Quentin Tarantino introduces her as Bloody Benton, in a story, and we get the flashback of her as the eight-armed Shiva shooting people. That look is also fucking dope. She's wearing this long hat with like, almost like long ropes coming off the bottom of it. But it was like fur, looked like wolf fur. I don't know. It was dope.
Yes.
And the gangs in town, like the Genji, all wore white, but it's not like they just gave them all the exact same white uniform. They all had unique outfits that were just primarily or, you know, secondary color was white in them to make it very clear that they were on the side
what
of the Genji.
Side?
But then they still had a lot of detail and they used a lot of character design, kind of like anime, to show something about how that person fought.
Also, the white gang, I feel like guys who wear tap-out shirts,
Casey,
if that's
Casey
how
the
they
Genji.
Feel like
we're calling
they look
them the
like.
Genji. We're not saying the white gang.
They wore white. The gang that wore white.
There we go.
I feel like, well, I mean, it stands both ways. Is how guys who wear tap outs like feel when they wear it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I like that for them. you know what I mean? Like, if it makes you that happy, don't let me shit on you.
You get it, girl.
Here's a particularly deep cut that very few people are gonna know. There's, you know, every once in a while you'll see some clothing on like Amazon or somewhere. But there's this one black mannequin that as soon as you see that mannequin's neckline, you know this jacket is not for you, sir. This is for small Korean men. No matter how many X's you put on the front of your order, it's not going to look on you like it does on that specific mannequin.
It reminds me of a muted... And this is going to be a bold claim, but it kind of reminds me of a muted version of set design from Double Dragon in the sense that, like, it's sort of outlandish in a way that is jarring to you putting it all together. And so it feels like there's these weird, distinct pieces of it.
Yeah. Pieces of it is a really good way to look at it because... At about the 1 hour mark, it suddenly clicked for me and it made a ton of sense that Tarantino showed up here and that the director of this is a fan of Tarantino and that they know each other, because this feels like it was made by somebody who is a Tarantino level fan of the pieces of films. You know,
gotcha.
How Tarantino is just, it's, yes. He doesn't, you know, yes. He doesn't write new things. He just reassembles. This was made by the Japanese version of that. Someone who obsessively knows movies. And I'm sure if I was more familiar with Japanese cinema and old Westerns, I'd probably know the specific movies he's piecing this together out of.
Yeah, like a Japanese Mr. Potato Head of
exactly.
Tarantino films.
I don't know how I feel about that imagery. All right, we gotta get off Tarantino. We have talked about this way too much.
I hope I don't.
Yeah.
I hope I never get him off.
I hope there's no context in which I need to get off of him.
Can we talk about another character that we didn't talk about at all during the plot, but is a very standout, weird character in this film?
Which
and that's
one?
The sheriff.
Oh, man. Yeah. I really spent a while deciding whether or not to write him into the plot. And I left him out because he technically doesn't really matter.
Right, right. But
what he does, because he sets off the like worst part of the movie.
That's true, yeah. But yeah, let's for the Cliff Notes background, yeah, the sheriff of this local town is working for the Hikies until he gets blackmailed. Or no, until the gunslinger enrolls him to work for him. He shows up a lot in the movie. He eventually kills Bloody Benton, and then he dies himself. That's how he fits into the movie.
Yes, and I so here's my question. He's sort of, his character defining traits are that he's a just absolute Weasley snitch that snitches on everyone at any point to anybody that'll listen.
Yeah,
and
he'll tell you anything you want if you just slightly threaten violence against him.
Correct.
But
yeah.
Also,
yeah, yeah,
he's clearly super mentally ill.
Well, that's what I want to get to. Is he mentally ill? Because at some point in the film, they lean really hard into him having two distinct personalities. One that's like trying to be goodish and the other one that's like the devil on his shoulder.
And then there's his driver.
Oh,
so
no,
there's
this
really
is,
three.
Yeah, this is not two distinct personalities. Homeboy is straight up Gollum. He is screaming at himself, Norway wants the hobbitses.
Right, okay. Right, right. He, well, he's more than screaming. He grabs himself by the face and pulls himself around and turns in different directions.
That almost made me want to nominate him for best actor of the film.
Okay.
Him having a fight with himself in the field where I'm like, this guy
Fair.
Went for it.
Yeah.
He did. And that's got to be tough.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right, right.
It's another really jarring element of the film because his first several scenes of the movie, none of this is fucking there.
He's a completely
different, pretty bog standard Western character. Like, okay, corrupt local sheriff in the pocket of the gang. I've got it. I understand who you are. And then a couple scenes later, he's all of a sudden, no, and it's the precious. And I'm confused as shit on where this came out of.
Yeah.
And you
know
what?
Just another layer of what the fuck
what
is
the
this,
fuck
Dave,
is
while
on?
I was watching it.
And he suffers an obscene amount of abuse.
He does. I'm going to say something kind of controversial. I was sympathetic for him at one point of the film.
Same.
I wasn't.
I want to say like round end of act two, like, okay, you know what? I see how you got here. I hope, like, I don't want you to get anything, but I hope you're just like running off into the desert at the end of the movie, right?
He's a cop and a snitch. He was definitely waiting to eat some lead.
My sympathy for him is definitely gone when the third act turns and he immediately goes out of his way to betray more people. It's extra work for him to show up as often as he does.
You could have gone somewhere else, man. You had to take it out.
I. And I got really confused by the Gollum story arc. I don't know where it came from. It suddenly ratchets up to like a 30 out of nowhere, and it is arguably the best acted scene in the film, but I'm just left here going, I have whiplash. I have fucking whiplash.
I think it implies that he is like that all the time because Bloody Benton is nice to him to the very end. Like, you can tell she's always taken pity on it. Like, so I think everybody in town knows. He might have just been the sheriff in name, maybe.
Yeah.
He's got a gun.
Did he ever
shoot a gun? Oh, hi. Look,
yes!
Where do we live?
He kills Bloody Benton.
Yeah. I know
with
a
it.
Lot of
yeah, but
people
we don't,
who
that
should
was at
not.
The very end of the movie. There was a lot of dead bodies.
Man, the sheriff was wild because he did my favorite thing, which was pretend to be dead, and then he ratcheted it up to a 12 and comically slowly rolled off into a ditch to get away.
With his arms pinned at his side.
Yes.
It was a really impressive little roll he had going.
We had multiple comical slow rolls to the side with arms pinned to the in this movie.
the hikey leader did it earlier in the movie, so I think that's why he let the sheriff get away. Like, you saw me do that. All right.
Game recognized game.
Right. Everybody gets one that someone else knows about.
And before we completely move on for the sheriff, we have to talk about how he dies. Because the sheriff kills Bloody Benton. And just as he's about to take the gold for himself, a fucking 5-foot-long cross suddenly sprouts through his chest before the camera zooms out to reveal that this thing has apparently been launched Grand Slam style from down the block by one of the Anasazi tribe's members.
Yeah. He threw it like a fucking tomahawk. There's a brief cut of it flying through the air behind him, but they don't really show it. So you have to kind of look to see it before it smashes into him. He threw it like a fucking like overhand tomahawk, so it spun end over end.
It's a grave marker.
Yeah. Yeah,
he killed a dude with someone else's grave marker.
It was kind of incredible. I first thought it fell off the burning church behind him because you see a cross fall off the burning church. And I was like, how did that like bounce and fucking pierce through him? Wow, that was gangster.
But no, it came from off screen, from downtown.
Yeah.
From the Anasazi tribes member, when the camera zooms over to reveal him posing in the follow through, this dude knew as soon as he released, he made his shot, and he was going to hold it for all to see.
Right. He was just—it's like bowling, man. You're just waiting to watch the pins fall.
Look at my glutes. I pulse. Okay.
Yeah, and this is not, again, mostly the type of movie where you expect to watch a foot and a half of rough wood suddenly sprout from a man's chest.
Covered in dirt.
I was not surprised at that moment, Dave, as I learned to stop being while watching this movie, and just was, of course that's going to happen. Wonder who threw that.
But there's a scene where a character says, you should go to the Anasazi. They keep to the old ways. And it cuts to one of these Native Americans or whatever standing over a cliff playing a trumpet. And there are writers who work their whole lives honing their craft to never write a joke that good. The only way you could have made that scene any better is if he had started playing the Sopranos, if he had started playing the Godfather song at da 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 da.
Listen, this is why I'm the most upset. Well, no, it's not why I'm the most upset with you, but it's why I'm one of the upsets with you. They waited till the end of the movie to give us the fight we wanted the whole movie. Because as soon as that lady approached the nameless gunslinger, I was like, she's special. I bet she fucking fights, bro. And you made me wait till the end of the movie and then you immediately kill her? Question?
I guess a lot of this is about the characters. And there are two characters in particular that we need to talk about. And that is the leader of the Genji and the leader of the Haiki. I don't know which one you guys want to start with first, but they're both characters.
They look like one of the lower level Shinigami in Bleach, like kind of like the guy with the whip sword had a baby with somebody else, and you have this guy's fucking wig and like his mankind leather bra for his hair,
and his red eyeliner and his constant like cock to the side head and slack jaw.
He looks straight out of an anime.
He's actually one of my favorite characters in the movie because of the specific movie stereotype that he fills, which is the like just kind of one amoral and two really lucky character that just survives by constantly throwing other people's bodies in front of him. There's
like
a scene,
the sheriff, amoral, random as fuck, but lucky.
Yeah, there's a scene early on in the movie when the Genji first show up to town. And the Haiki leader we're talking about immediately steps behind one of his other lieutenants. Which, good timing, because that lieutenant gets blasted in the chest immediately. Gigantic hole. The Heike later stands behind another one of his guys. Again, good timing. That guy immediately dies too. And then the Heike leader just stands behind a third of his guys and says, "We need to fatten you up."
Yeah, yeah.
Kaya.
And then he also makes everybody stand in front of him as he carries the Gatlin gun into town. It is literally his MO. That is his signature move.
100%. Just have other people stand in front of him and then pop out in his ye olde bulletproof vest and Gatling gun, which is just like the most unfair cheat code way to show up to this time frame.
Hey, it was a great strategy.
I mean, hey, if you've got access to it, I understand. That's the choice I'm making.
I also wondered when he was getting shot why he wasn't dying, especially when then the guy afterwards got shot and died, and then they reveal his fucking armor.
Yeah, for a while you're wondering, like, how is this guy, like, the leader of a
just
gang?
Just tanking bullets and shit.
Yeah.
And I thought, like, oh, okay, maybe he's just that guy that just never goes down, and he's the Homer Simpson of the samurai world. And no matter what happens, he's always standing at the end of the fight. And you reveal, no, he's just wearing an entire-ass bulletproof vest.
Kind of like a steel Argyle sweater vest.
All right, well, before we inevitably get back to talking about some other weird-ass shit Quentin Tarantino did in this.
Or we suspect he did on set.
Oh, God, that's an endless list. We need to get on with things and ask the questions we do every week. So, Casey, let's kick this off with you. I suspect I know the answer, given your fury with me throughout tonight. But from 2007, Sukiyaki, Western Django, would you watch it again?
I wanted really bad to like this because most of the time the visuals were on for me. You know, the opening is jarring at first, but once it took me a second, I enjoyed it, especially when he started killing people and the blood like splattered on the background. I thought it was really cool looking. But God, whether it's intentional or not, some of the discomfort with this film that is just, it's kind of like that super awkward comedy that I don't enjoy. Like, I get there's an audience out there for it. It's not for me, but I wanted to like this. But no, I would not watch this again. Twice was too much. I would go back and watch like one of the end fight scenes. I would watch BB's fight scene. But no, I'm good.
It was
okay.
Like 20 minutes. I did not realize on the first viewing how long that last fight is.
Yes, it is the last sixth of the movie. Jay, I think I know your answer because I watched it with you, but indulge. 2007 Sukiyaki Western Django. Would you watch it again? And if you are, watch it at Dave's.
I will say that as I kept watching this, I thought this really is peak shitty cinema. The film has some beautiful aesthetics. It's a train wreck of genres and tones smashed together. I don't know. I called it at one point a Western wearing samurai clothing. I don't know if that's accurate, but it feels in the ballpark of what's going on. However, I struggled through this film. It wasn't just some of the like weird, awkward, jarring things or the way too many fucking rape scenes that we had. But I don't think that I really like Westerns a ton. And I just struggled to really care. I was really excited a lot of times when characters were just getting killed because I'm like, good, please, please get them all gone off my screen. And it was a slog for me to get through. So I'm glad that I had the massively weird and absurd experience that was Sukiyaki Western Django, but no, I will not be watching it again. Dave, what about you? You brought this. Sukiyaki Western Django, would you watch it again?
I did bring this, man. And man, if anybody set up to give this the best possible chance, it's me. I love Japanese movies. I love action comedy. I love Tarantino movies. I love Westerns. This movie was still a fucking lot for me, man.
Okay, that makes me feel a little better.
I never quite know what to expect from it. Jay, you said that it at times felt like a Western in samurai clothes. I think this is actually more like the cinematic equivalent of Telephone.
Yeah.
Like Western,
I can see that.
Western and samurai movies are already a fucking circle. All the Westerns are based on Kurosawa. Kurosawa was inspired by the works of John Ford. It's just turtles all the way down, man. So if you just keep doing that with an ocean between them, 100-ish years later, you get this. And it is so fucking weird. Oh, man. I find this movie fucking fascinating. So I think, despite the parts that are jarring, yeah, I'm going to watch this again at some point. I am going to say I'm going to use that skip 30 button a lot more liberally next time. I'm not following
along. Yeah, that helped.
On Shizuka's storyline. So that's it, listeners. 1 out of 3 of us is going to watch this again. 2 out of 3 are probably a bit more reasonable, let's be honest. Something's broken with me. But what about you? Have you seen it before? Would you watch it again? Let us know. So that's my pick for Dog Ate My Homework. Jay, what are we going to be watching next week?
Next week, we're going to watch a film from the Philippines made in 1981, starring the shortest man ever to be lead in a feature film. It's a James Bond spoof called For Your Height Only.
I'm so excited about this. So excited about this.
All right, so we're just going to shift gears to a different type of wildly disrespectful next week.
No. This is pure class, start to finish. Before we get a touch of class, follow us on Instagram at casey.cinema, like us on Facebook, sh.ttycinema. Donate to our We're Buying Guns from Quentin Tarantino, yes, the real one, on Patreon /shittycinema or peepshittycinema.com. Check the show notes for those links, and let's turn out the lights. Get a pocket full of gold.
Oh!
And leave this weird, rapey town behind.